It's the 13th of May 2011 and you're listening to The Pod Delusion, a podcast about interesting things. I'm James O'Malley. Coming up this week, we answer the questions: should Nick Clegg admit mea culpa, or maybe just mea twat? Should the privacy laws allow us to allegedly dress up as Nazis with whoever we like behind closed doors? How are Sony dealing with the PlayStation 3's little big fuck-up? Is creationism the biggest threat to education today, or should we start with media studies? Can we explain the science behind why people believe in a deity? And if Uganda say they don't want homosexuals in their country, will Chris Grayling sort of be able to see where they're coming from? But first, in a game of cards with homeopaths, does playing the race card trump everything else? Yesterday there was a surprising twist in the ongoing war on homeopathy. It was discovered that on a homeopathy discussion forum, one of their members was suggesting the race card be played in combating complaints against homeopathy advertising. Here's Sean Ellis making me slightly nervous with his impressions with more.
Hello there, and welcome to the Black and White Homeopath Show.
Was that offensive? Good. Sorry.
But putting on a cod accent and doing jazz hands, which is great on a podcast, is nothing compared to what popped up on the web today. The Advertising Standards Authority has recently extended its remit to include websites, and the sceptical posse online have helped them by pointing out a lot of unsubstantiated twaddle on commercial pages. As one of the top purveyors of unsubstantiated twaddle, homeopaths have felt the sharp end of this effort, and many of them are finding it rather uncomfortable. Sue Trotter is a homeopath and life coach working in Gloucestershire. She also gives out advice in various forums, including in one case the suggestion of using homeopathic electricity for an acute severe burn based on the shape of the burn itself. The homeopathy world community is kind of a Facebook for homeopaths, and today Sue posted a whinge about ASA complaints. What was notable wasn't the whinge itself, it's all standard stuff. Instead, it was her proposed solution to the problem. That catapulted her into the limelight. We think we've come up with a plan to put an end to this nonsense. We can play the race discrimination card if we get this right. Please bear with me whilst I explain. If we can find some British Indians or Pakistanis or Bangladeshis, they can complain to the ASA, explaining that homeopathy is a preferred system of medicine in the countries of origin, used to treat a wide range of illnesses. The current wave of complaints against homeopaths would therefore seem to be an attack on their culture and beliefs, and therefore discriminatory. This is reprehensible conduct. It was posted at about 11:30 a.m. our time, and taken down at 3:30 p.m. In the 4 hours it was up, did it receive any kind of rebuke from the other homeopaths on the forum? No, just the opposite. Twitter-aware Debbie Bruck was one of the first to like the page, and, I apologise if I mispronounce this, Dr. Waqar Ali Khan stated, "The approach may work if, as stated, we would need to get a smart lawyer to draft the letters, but if we could get the ASA to look at the potential discrimination, that they may well decide to back off. A novel approach." So, what appears to be happening here is that someone is publicly posting their plan to avoid legitimate regulation, abusing legislation designed to protect the rights of minorities. She's quite blatant about this. I know homeopathy is not a belief system, but many think it is, so why not use that to our advantage? We would need to get a smart lawyer to draft the letters, but if we could get the ASA to look at this as potential discrimination, they may well decide to back off. If we can find someone on the ASA's complaint list whose family hail from the Indian subcontinent to complain they're being discriminated against, even better. And if the ASA find in their favour but still go for those of us of European descent, we can then go for a different race discrimination angle. I'm not sure what's more stupid about all of this. That she thought of this in the first place, that she thought it would be a good idea to post it in public, or that she thought for one moment that it wouldn't blow up spectacularly in her face. As usual, when homeopaths behave badly, the rest of the community rallies round rather than condemning it, and I expect the same to happen here. Now, treating AIDS in Africa is an order of magnitude worse than this, but hiding behind the protections devised for the oppressed and vulnerable is another low point for the profession. I call on homeopaths everywhere to condemn Sue Trotter's actions. I don't expect for a moment that they will. In the meantime, Sue, play the race card Trotter, will take some considerable time to be rid of her new nickname, and the ASA will presumably be sharpening up their smart lawyers. This is Sean, where am dat watermelon, Ellis, for the Pod Delusion.
Now, last week, the Lib Dems got a good thrashing at the local elections. And it's a bit late now, but Lib Dem activist Jenny Rigg thinks there's only one way the Lib Dems are going to be able to recover. And that's by Nick Clegg swallowing all of his pride and saying sorry for betraying everyone's trust. Considering all of the crap that Nick has been swallowing from the Tories, you'd think that swallowing your pride would be a much more straightforward and much tastier thing to do. Here's Jenny, explaining more.
Hello, my name is Jenny, and I'm a Lib Dem. I seem to be doing the Alcoholics Anonymous introduction a lot, and I think I know why. The Lib Dems took a pretty severe battering in the various elections last week, and it finally seems to be getting through to the higher-ups in the party what those of us on the ground have known for quite some time. The electorate are really, really pissed off with us. The consensus seems to be that what happened with tuition fees is the problem, and us activists are getting a lot of emails from head office busily briefing us on how we did the best we could with a bad hand, and that we ought to be telling people this. And you know what? I have been telling people this, and people have been telling me back that they don't care. Tuition fees are not the problem. What happened with tuition fees is the proof, not the crime. You see, people know that we are the junior partner in the coalition. They know that we couldn't be expected to enact Lib Dem policy on tuition fees because the Tories would never have let us abolish them. People know that a manifesto commitment is more of a wish list than a cast-iron promise. Bleating on about those facts is only making things worse. The nuance of what happened with tuition fees isn't the problem. The problem is that every last one of our MPs signed a personal pledge to vote against any rise in tuition fees, and then most of them voted for it. It's not that our voters disagree with our policy. Party policy is still to abolish tuition fees after all. It's a matter of personal honour. A manifesto commitment is one thing, but a personal pledge is quite another. We ran our whole damn general election campaign on no more broken promises. We're not like all the others, we said. Vote for us and things will change, we said. We're honest, we said. And then a bunch of our elected representatives broke their word. When the news came out that this is what Clegg was planning to do, several of us in the party, and not just ranters like me, but thoughtful bloggers like David Matthewman, blogged Cassandra like that this would be a huge error. Some of us spotted it in the coalition agreement, the clause about abstaining rather than voting against, and we made noises at special conference because even at that early stage it was clear that this was going to cause an issue. Our warnings went unheeded. The thing that doesn't seem to be getting through to the leadership is that it doesn't even matter if most of our MPs breaking their word made things better than they would have been if they'd kept it. And what eventually happened with tuition fees falls into that category. If we'd voted against or abstained as per the coalition agreement, the Brown Report would have gone in as was, and fees would be uncapped and students would be suffering a hell of a lot worse. That's really not the issue. People really genuinely believed that we were different. I know this because ordinary voters told me so. Lots of them. It doesn't matter that up and down the country hundreds of Lib Dem councillors and thousands of Lib Dem activists have been busily keeping their word for decades. 36 of our MPs didn't keep theirs, and that tars all of us with the brush of liar. In that one simple act of word-breaking, those 36 Lib Dem MPs who voted for the bill or abstained from it when they'd pledged to vote against undid decades of hard work by thousands of other Lib Dems, including those honourable 21 MPs who kept the pledge. If you'll break your word on that, the electorate say, how can we trust you with anything? Those 36 people cost the jobs of hundreds of Lib Dem councillors, and they cost lots of areas of the country a good working council. They contributed towards costing us the AV referendum, and yeah, I acknowledge the Yes campaign was woeful, but the toxicity of being associated with the Lib Dems didn't help. But worst of all, they've cost us our USP. What made us different in the eyes of the electorate is gone. The voters thought we were different, and now they think we've proved we're not. And yes, I know Labour and Tory politicians break their word all the time and they don't get this level of punishment. That's because people expect it from them. They didn't expect it from us, and now they do. The electorate now think that we are exactly the same as all the others. A lot of the party top brass are saying we need to win back the trust of students. It's not just the trust of students we need to win back. It's the trust of everybody, because everybody saw us do it. And it's going to be incredibly difficult. It may take decades again. I don't know what all the steps involved will be, but I do know that the first couple of steps are very simple. The first step is for the Lib Dem leadership, and Nick Clegg in particular, to actually acknowledge what the problem is. People are upset that you broke your word, and they're right to be angered by that. The second step is to apologise. Apologise unreservedly and without qualification. Any, and I mean any, attempt to qualify an apology, to dress it up in fancy words, to say that what we pledged to do would have made things worse, to say that we did the best we could. And anyway, look at all these other promises we've kept. You can't be cross about just one. Look at all the others. That's going to make people angrier, because it'll make them think that you still don't get why they are angry. It's a very simple sentence you need to say, you 36 individuals who have damaged the party for the thousands of us who make up the rest. You need to say, "I'm sorry I broke my word." And you need to say that sentence over and over again until people believe you. And even then, it probably won't be enough, because they'll think you're only sorry because it's cost you votes, not because you realise it was wrong. Only when people believe that all of us Lib Dems know that breaking promises is bad and wrong and hurts people, only then can we start to rebuild trust with the electorate. Only then can we start trying to fix this. No amount of trying before an apology is made is going to butter any parsnips. I still believe in my party. I still believe that our policies, which I and many thousands of others have worked hard on, are better than the policies of any other party. I'm still immensely proud that our party fights hard for LGBTQ rights, that we have Julian Huppert being a one-man army for sense about science and evidence-based policy making, and that we're fighting in government for the NHS and employment rights, and many, many other things that I believe in. And I'm really, really disappointed that the actions of 36 people out of a party of thousands have tarnished all that in the eyes of huge swathes of the country. But because I'm a Lib Dem, I'm going to stick around to help sort it out. This has been Jenny Rigg, more in sorrow than in anger, for the Pod Delusion.
Now, James Firth this week has been thinking about the privacy laws. This week we've seen much debate in the news following the ruling on Max Mosley, the ongoing super injunction faff, and the debate about how much privacy people in the public eye can reasonably expect to have. Personally, I think we're looking at the issue upside down. It's not about how much privacy people are allowed, but it should be about how much privacy the general public is willing to grant someone. For example, if they let Kelvin McKenzie put his face on my TV again, then he's not got anywhere near enough privacy, and would, under my proposed laws, be forced to wear a bag on his head with a rolled-up sock in his mouth. It's a bit harsh, perhaps, but I'm fairly certain that most people will agree that shutting him up would definitely be within the public interest. But anyway, with a slightly different take, here's James Firth with more.
As someone on the record as claiming to defend personal privacy as an important part of our human rights in the digital world, I've recently been accused of hypocrisy because I've warned against regulation of social websites in light of the recent super injunction-busting tweets on Twitter. In fact, I've gone a stage further. I've suggested that personal privacy rights perhaps should not apply in many of the alleged cases uncovered. Yet I argue that I still care deeply about personal privacy. My defence against the hypocrisy allegation partly encompasses a concept in US law that politicians and celebrities in the public eye should not be afforded equivalent rights against press intrusion as, quote, ordinary citizens. But my argument goes further in trying to separate three concepts that have become conjoined in an orgy of legal and sociological bartering to produce the bastard child that is the super-injunction culture of the rich and powerful. The first concept is whether our fascination with other people's sex lives is ultimately a healthy occupation and beneficial to society. The second relates to freedom of the press, and the third is an attempt to explore what real lasting damage is done by privacy breaches, together with the concept of privacy itself. Asked in isolation whether we should move away from a culture where sex sells newspapers, many might agree. But I feel it's wrong to try and achieve this end goal by force, by wielding the super injunction stick, by applying constraints on free speech. In many respects, it's a great shame that what should be a discussion about protecting investigative journalism has become mired in a slanging match on whether or not a sex scandal should be news. I argue that it's beyond the capacity of any individual, even a High Court judge, sitting in secret, to decide consistently and with accuracy what does and what does not represent public interest. Especially given arguments are presented by expensive lawyers, and many, new media outlets especially, don't have the money to pay their own writers, never mind £20,000 or so, to challenge an injunction. Particularly nasty about a super injunction is that it prohibits other potentially interested parties, i.e. other news outlets, potentially with deeper pockets, to challenge the decision made in private by the judge, as the respondent is legally barred from disclosing the injunction to any third party. There's clearly no right answer, but I feel the lesser evil is to remove all forms of prior restraint, postponing any potential legal challenge and damages hearing until after the article is published. Taking sex out of the equation, it's vitally important that journalists are free to investigate difficult and complex cases where powerful interests will, and often do anything in their power to prevent publication. Whether this be claiming a corporation has a right to privacy, or using the outmoded legal argument that image and reputation is analogous to property, and doing anything to damage one's image and reputation is tantamount to property damage or theft. Prior restraint in the form of injunctions issued in closed court are quite simply dangerous to democracy. As well as hiding the embarrassment of celebrities, they can, and so it appears have, been used to mask wrongdoing. Back on the concept of sex, celebrity and privacy, it's important to understand how the notion in US law emerged, so that a celebrity has fewer rights against press intrusion than other citizens. It's perhaps easy enough to understand with elected politicians, since they're clearly in a position of power. Transparency and acting responsibly is, I believe, an acceptable price of office. And yes, before you ask, I did consider this before I stood for election to the local council last week. In fact, I considered this before I started blogging and podcasting. Because celebrities, and journalists even, are in a similar position of influence. They can persuade their fans to choose one brand of football boot or soft drink above another. And the fans who trust the celebrity endorsement want to know all they can about the moral conduct of that celebrity as part of the bond of trust. But is it right that sexual conduct should be of interest as part of this trust equation? Is an adulterous politician any worse at leading than one who's faithful to their partner? Does a footballer's love of threesomes affect their ability to recommend one brand of sports equipment above another? Probably not. But it does say something at a subconscious level about the conduct of those we elect or admire. Take adultery. The ability of a politician to deceive their partner may well belie their ability to deceive the electorate. And I wonder now whether public interest is a separate concept from that which interests the public. Taken as a premise that, on the whole, the population acts in the general good of society, rather than through individual self-interest and survival, maybe we should just accept that people want to know such things about the sex lives of those who influence us. Whether or not we judge people on their sexual conduct should again be seen as a separate question to whether details once emerged should be kept from the public through injunction. Having said all this, privacy is still a vitally important concept to society. Privacy is the ability to create a space free from intrusion. Such a space is important for several reasons, not least of which to experiment, learn and develop oneself without risk of being judged, to relax and rebuild without the constant feeling of being observed. Any new privacy laws should focus on investigative methods, not censoring information once it has been uncovered. For example, Clive Goodman was a News of the World reporter imprisoned in 2007 for his role in the original phone hacking scandal. I have no problem with reporters who cross the line of acceptability in their methods, who intrude on others, being punished for that intrusion. But I have a very big problem with anyone attempting to control the information once it's become available. The idea that Twitter is an unregulated free-for-all is a myth and blatant scaremongering. It might not fall under formal regulatory structures, but it is socially regulated. People are free to choose who they follow. Social capital is as easily lost than won, so bloggers and journalists with a reputation for false stories will lose out to those consistently publishing the truth. Another important issue is that the public are far more intelligent than judges or policymakers acknowledge. While I've heard it said by many people from many sections of society, don't believe everything you read in, insert name of your favourite tabloid newspaper. The willingness to disbelieve what's published must only increase online, where the readers of blogs surely are aware of the limited ability of many bloggers to gather news and the absence of most editorial checks and balances. All this needs to be taken into account when considering the actual damage caused by any wrongful allegation or privacy invasion. Gossip and rumour doesn't necessarily have the damaging effect on our image and reputation as we might think it does. On the specific relationship between injunctions and privacy, there's a unique perversity. For me, privacy includes privacy from the state, as well as from other people. Yet in allowing the legal system to rule over what is and what isn't private, places our privacy in the hands of the state. But above all, given the internet, the notion that any one person or organisation can control information is well and truly busted. Yet this doesn't seem to have sunk in, and I'm worried in the short term as governments and competing commercial interests all seem to have stepped up their rhetoric in an attempt to assert control. Any control structure imposed on information sent over the internet could be costly, ultimately futile, and arrest the development in our use of information technology for several years. This is James Firth reporting for The Pod Delusion.
Now, have you heard about the new PlayStation Grand Theft Auto game? Apparently, it's so immersive, it feels as though you're actually being robbed. I am, of course, referring to the PlayStation Network hack, in which thousands of people's details have been stolen. Presumably, next time they log into PlayStation Home, they'll find all of their windows smashed and all of their stuff missing. Still, we should have known that the PlayStation was insecure back when Psycho Mantis read our memory cards. If only Sony had saved all of that personal data on their proprietary UMD format, then no one would have anything on which to read it. Are these quips a bit obscure? Either way, it's an interesting tale, and Sony are currently trying to blame Anonymous for the hack. And apparently this is a bit silly. Why? Here's Salim Fadley with more.
If you own a Sony PlayStation 3 games console, you might not be getting the full experience you originally paid for. Since April the 20th, the PlayStation Network has been offline, preventing PlayStation users from participating in multiplayer games or buying new games via Sony's in-console game store. In an act of desperate damage control, Sony Entertainment blamed Anonymous for their woe. Is this the corporate version of when little children blame Mr. Nobody for minor domestic naughtiness? And why did the naughty Anonymous push over Sony's precious little network? A few months ago, a teenager called George Hotz found a way to re-enable a feature which Sony had intentionally removed from first-generation PS3 consoles. The product originally had the ability to run the Linux operating system in addition to playing Sony's games. The feature was called Other OS. People liked it because it allowed a PS3 to be used as a low-cost computer. In March 2010, Sony released a firmware update which permanently disabled this feature. Sony alleged that the Other OS feature was being abused in order to play illegally copied games. The feature was removed to prevent subsequent abuses. Technically, nobody was forced to receive the update. You could decline it. but users were faced with a stark choice. You could keep your other OS feature intact at the cost of renouncing all further device updates and losing the ability to play online. Your PS3 would be stuck in March 2010 forevermore. Alternatively, you can have your updates if you allow Sony to disable this feature, which you did originally pay for. But if you want both, then tough luck. Many PS3 owners were upset as they believed that Sony had no moral right to remove the feature, even if they grudgingly admitted that the small print terms of service probably did give Sony a legal right to do what they wanted. George Hotz, who goes by the nickname GeoHot, was one of those annoyed PS3 owners. He's also a gifted software developer with a knack for opening up closed-off systems. He was already something of a hacker folk hero, having developed one of the very first iPhone jailbreaks. He found a way to re-enable other OS, and he published his solution on his personal blog so that others could reclaim their console's original abilities. Sony responded by suing Hotz. His home was raided, his computer equipment was confiscated as evidence, he was threatened with terrible legal consequences if he continued publishing his PS3 research. The community responded in outrage that the commercial giant Sony would use their full might against a teenager. Sony was effectively declaring war on somebody who appeared to be fighting for the users. After months of disregard for their customers, this act of corporate bullying inspired the anonymous Operation Sony. An article published last week by the Financial Times entitled "Hackers Point Finger Over Sony Incursion" claimed to have insider knowledge from unnamed members of the activist group who allegedly acknowledged that some other members of the group might possibly be responsible for the attack on Sony. The article directly links unnamed anonymous members to the theft of the data. But is it even credible that individuals operating under the anonymous banner were responsible for Sony's troubles? The attack on Sony's network involved a vast identity theft, affecting millions of users whose personal details were stored on the PlayStation network. Theft of personal details, particularly credit card information, is a common form of online organized crime. The details can be sold on via covert brokers at great profit. This seems totally out of character for Anonymous, whose acts of revenge are normally motivated by a bizarre kind of poetic justice and a delight in spectacular pranks. They've never previously been motivated by financial gain. In any case, Anonymous actions are planned in plain sight on pseudonymous bulletin boards such as 4chan. It's not the sort of place to plan a data heist other than your personal identity. There's no privacy. Anybody attempting to launder stolen credit card data would be instantly discovered. A more likely alternative is that real computer criminals exploited the chaos caused by the anonymous operation as cover for their own crimes. It's sort of like using a large chaotic protest as a cover for shoplifting. Sony probably found it easier to blame Anonymous rather than admit that their own network was insufficiently protected against run-of-the-mill data theft. The problem with blaming Anonymous is that the name does not refer to a specific organisation. It's not a well-defined group with a founder, a permanent membership, or even a hierarchy. If anything, it's an internet meme like rickrolling, goat sex, or shouting, "The cake is a lie!" Blaming Anonymous for your problems is like blaming the hamster dance or a rude joke. Anonymous is a viral idea which motivates a particular kind of direct action. The idea is an old one. When you get upset about something, you can join together with other people who feel like you and stage an online equivalent of a protest rally. Instead of smashing a window, you can smash a network. So when Sony blame Anonymous for their problems, it's as absurd as when a Middle Eastern despot blames street protests rather than their own failures as leaders. The only reason that the mob is protesting is on account that they managed to offend so many people in the first place. Sony are effectively admitting, "We pissed off so many people that they turned against us." It's the excuse that's no excuse at all. It's a confession of being utterly out of touch with their customers. Most bizarrely of all, by blaming Anonymous for their pathetic defeat, Sony have once again validated the Anonymous protest strategy. the list of successful anonymous operations, which includes sinister religious groups, evil dictators and corrupt corporations, has a new inductee. Anonymous Pwned Sony. This is Salim Fadley for The Pod Delusion.
Now, a new campaign was launched this week over the teaching of creationism in schools in Britain. Apparently, it's getting worse. Personally, I think the creationists are using the wrong tactics. Trying to get it into science lessons or even RE lessons is obviously going to be met by opposition by geeks like us. If, however, they campaign to teach creationism as part of PE, I, for one, would be a lot more sympathetic to their cause. And anyway, PE teachers are already pretty thick as it is, so why not exploit this weak link? I'm not sure why I'm giving them tactics, but anyway, here's Liz Luckendorf with more.
This week saw the joint launch of the Crisis Campaign, which stands for Creationism in Schools Isn't Science. The skeptic and rationalist among us will probably agree wholeheartedly with the campaign, and yet despair that it's needed in the first place. The group that is going into schools and teaching creationism is called the Creation Ministries International, and the leader of this group, Philip Bell, actively wants to be a ministry to students. I had a few minutes after Skeptics in the Pub in London on Wednesday night to talk with Tessa, who is actively involved with the Crisis campaign.
Okay, so I'm sitting here with Tessa from Skeptics in the Pub, and this week there was the Crisis campaign was launched. Could you tell us about the background to the Crisis campaign?
The campaign came about because a woman called Laura Horner sends her children to a church school, and she found out that a creationist group had come into the school and were being allowed by the school to teach creationism as if it were science. And she complained to the school and they said, well, we're allowed to do this. And she looked into it and she found out that the guidelines that are issued by the government are a bit slippery and they do allow this. So she started this campaign to pressurise the government to change the guidelines to stop creationists being allowed to go into schools and teach creationism as science.
Well, we as skeptics probably know why this is very important to stop, but what's the wider issue to general education, why this is important?
There are two issues here. First of all, for younger children in particular, if they're being presented something as science, they don't have necessarily the critical faculties to know that it isn't. They're being presented with an authority figure. There's also a knock-on effect that children who believe this kind of thing, in America, for example, young people are not getting into university because they've got Bible-based education, and it's being considered that they're not adequately qualified to get to university. So there is a knock-on effect in the way young people think about things later on and the way they approach facts. And the other implication is that with all the free schools that are going to be opening, quite a lot of them run by religious organisations, and a lot of schools, church schools, converting to academies, there's going to be windows for creationists to get in and teach children.
To get to the campaign itself, what exactly are your first steps?
There are two steps in the campaign. Firstly, there's a petition that you can sign, and also Crisis, Creationism in Schools Isn't Science, are going to be writing to the Secretary for Education, Michael Gove, to go and pressure him to tighten up the guidelines. And a lot of people have signed this letter. It's an open letter. People like Richard Dawkins, Julian Huppert, Simon Singh, Professor Chris French, the National Secular Society, who I work for, we've signed it. And but the interesting thing is it's not just scientists and people talking about it. There are also religious people who are on board with this. Laura herself is a believer. We've got Ecclesia, which is a Christian think tank. Various theologians and important religious people have also got behind the campaign because they don't think creationism should be taught as science either. And that's what makes it a bit different. It's not just Richard Dawkins standing up and saying this. It's a broad mix of people.
So for people listening at home who may not have been aware of this campaign, is there a way for them to get involved as well and to support it?
The main way you can support it is to tell people about it. If you find out, if you have children or if there's a school near you and you find out the creationists are teaching, get in touch with Crisis or get in touch with the National Secular Society and sign the petition.
Tessa from Skeptics in the Pub, thank you very much.
Thank you.
For more information about the Crisis campaign, follow the links on the Pod Delusion website. As well, you'll find links to the petition you can sign to support Crisis in its efforts. And if you have children, you might want to find out what's going on at the RE classes. In the words of Baba Brinkman, creationism is dead wrong. Let's make sure UK school kids know that too. This is Liz Luchtendorf, reporting for The Pod Delusion.
Staying with weird beliefs now, and a couple of weeks ago the Telegraph reported that scientists had apparently figured out that children are born to believe in God. Maybe I was just reading too much into it, but it seemed to be touted as a sort of a take that atheists, religion is genetic sort of statement. Obviously this argument is rubbish though, because why should you trust a child's opinion? After all, we all know that children are idiots. Well, if you don't believe me, earlier on I asked a child their opinions on a number of issues, and if you go with what a child says, then girls are unpleasant and smell, high-up cupboards are frustrating, and that the Tories are the party of the NHS. But anyway, to get to the bottom of this, Jordan Main has been looking into why people do believe in deities.
This week, James drew my attention to something in the archives. Children are born believers in God, the Telegraph had headlined in its religion section. The Times had covered the same story with Why Do We Believe in God? 2 million study prays for an answer. It was all about a study funded by a grant from the Templeton Foundation. Psychologist Dr. Justin Barrett and philosopher Professor Roger Trigg's team in Oxford were, and I quote from Dr. Barrett, interested in exploring exactly in what sense belief in God is natural. And it would be strange, I suppose, if such a thing as belief in the supernatural was not natural, given how widespread it is. It's a thought many have pondered. Why do we as a species come up with these ideas again and again? The father of psychology, William James, wrote about a quality he called religious genius. He noted that religious instigators have often shown signs of nervous instability, exalted emotional sensibility, and presented all sorts of peculiarities which are ordinarily classed as pathological. For James, those others who follow on from these primary agents have what he called a second-hand religious life. He seems to regard it as a form of intellectual contagion from a concentrated source. However, the prevailing theories about religiosity have changed since James' day. Charismatic individuals certainly have shaped some of the specifics of our notions about the supernatural, but a spontaneous sense of it seems to be more evenly distributed among the population than he thought. There are a couple of ideas about how we've become a supernatural-seeking species. The first is that belief in a transcendent power confers an advantage upon a group. This would make religiosity a primary quality for survival by, for example, enhancing commitment to the group. One of the most notable popularizers of this theory was the father of sociobiology, E.O. Wilson, who said, "Men would rather believe than know." But there are several detractors to this theory, people who don't believe that group selection is anywhere near as important a factor in survival as has been claimed, which would leave the God as an adaptive trait theory looking a bit wan. The second, and probably more currently popular way of looking at the issue, is to see superstition and religion as byproducts of evolution. Paleontologist Stephen Jay Gould and population geneticist Richard Lewontin co-opted the architectural term spandrel to define something which didn't originate by the direct action of natural selection, but which later became usefully employed for a different function. So is God somehow a side effect of our cognitive machinery, an accompaniment to evolution? David Hume wrote that we find human faces in the moon, armies in the clouds, and by a natural propensity, if not corrected by experience and reflection, ascribe malice and goodwill to everything that hurts or pleases us. Taking indistinct stimuli from the environment and making them into something recognisable is a phenomenon known as pareidolia. It's how the Virgin Mary gets onto so many pieces of toast. Either that or she's got a really good agent. Anyway, Hume was pointing out what many others have noticed before and since. We see things that aren't there, and then often ascribe personalities and intentions to them. Dr. Barrett's term for this kind of thing is a hyperactive or hypersensitive agency detection device, a HAD. Philosopher Daniel Dennett puts it that we have an intentional stance, and that means identifying agents with limited beliefs about the world, specific desires, and enough common sense to do the rational thing, given those beliefs and desires. This takes us to theory of mind, a term created by David Premack and Guy Woodruff, who defined it as the ability to attribute mental states, beliefs, intents, desires, pretending, knowledge, etc., to oneself and others, and to understand that others have beliefs, desires, and intentions that are different from one's own. You can imagine how useful this is. It helps us to predict what others are going to do and want. It helps us to understand that they have a theory of mind about us in turn. The issue with these agent detection and prediction abilities is that they're very hard to turn off. A false positive is probably not often dangerous. Who ever got hurt for mistaking a tree bark for a face? But a false negative is dangerous. How often do you get to ignore a hungry tiger? Another way in which we get to see a world of our own making is to have a preference for purpose-based explanations. Psychologist Dr. Deborah Kellerman of the Child Cognition Lab at Boston University is the expert here. Her work on children showed that they had preferences for what she called teleofunctional explanations. Why is the stone in the middle of the garden? Because it likes to catch the sun. What's more, she found that children displayed what she called promiscuous teleology, that is, applying purpose-based explanations to both living and natural but inanimate things alike. So do we naturally grow out of this kind of reasoning, or do the physics lessons at school have an effect after all? Kellerman's work on uneducated adults amongst the Romanian Roma show that giving up purpose-based explanations as we grow is a cultural phenomenon, not a natural event. Left to our own devices, we'd probably all be adult animists, searching for motivations of seen and unseen agents in our environments. I've noticed this a great deal in my study of the folklore of the macabre. People really aren't stupid. They know that events have proximal causes. It's the search for meaning which helps to create the agent. The anthropologist E.E. Evans-Pritchard spent a great deal of time with a Central African tribe, the Azandi. One day, a house collapsed on somebody. Villagers knew that the termites had undermined the house, but that wasn't the question. Why had it happened when that particular person was sitting there? They weren't answering the question how. They were answering the question why. It reminds me of medieval Europeans who felt leprosy to be a disease associated with moral degeneracy. You could probably have proved the existence of disease-causing microorganisms to our ancestors, but it may not have stopped them from asking why. Why now? Why him? Why here? This is just a tiny start on the factors which predispose us to intuit the supernatural. If you're interested in more, you could do an awful lot worse than buy Bruce Hood's Supersense. So if a sense of the supernatural is a side effect of our biology, will ghosts and gods, phantoms and fairies always be with us? Dr. Barrett, a Christian himself, was quoted as saying, "If we threw a handful on an island and they raised themselves, I think they would believe in God." But I think this is going far too far. For one thing, that term God rather than gods. Monotheism is the exception rather than the rule in religion. And perhaps our island-bound handful would have day-to-day interactions with ancestors rather than gods, in the manner of African religions. I think it would be fairer to say that they would likely end up with a supernatural model of their environment, as well as a natural one. As anthropologist Pascal Boyer wrote, "Having a normal brain does not imply that you have religion. All it implies is that you can acquire it, which is very different."
Sort of good news this week coming out of Uganda, where the law that would have made homosexuality a capital offence hasn't passed. But it's still not great news. I don't think we're going to see Uganda entering Eurovision or walking a tiny dog anytime soon. Here's Natalie Zerins to explain why.
This week, the Parliament of Uganda threatened to revisit a controversial piece of anti-gay legislation that was originally proposed by an MP in 2009, with fears raised that it may have been hastily implemented before the Ugandan parliamentary session ended on Wednesday. It looks like they've dropped the bill from this parliamentary session. Whether this is for good or not, we don't know. Before last week, it looked like they had quietly shelved it, offering it next to no attention for 18 months, and a new parliament's due to be sworn in over the next week. So what was it all about? Although homosexual acts were already illegal in Uganda, earning you up to 14 years in prison, the bill, proposed by MP David Bahati, would originally have made the offence of aggravated homosexuality punishable by death. The bill defined aggravated homosexuality as homosexual acts with a disabled person or a person under the age of 18, as well as being an active homosexual with HIV. Also, the bill in its originally proposed form contained a provision for capital punishment for serial offenders under other parts of the law. Despite worldwide condemnation of the bill, it looked likely that it might pass, apparently having the support of 99% of MPs, according to John Otikatimil, an independent MP. However, hopes were raised that it would not pass in the form that it was originally proposed. Uganda's president, Yoweri Museveni, despite voicing his support for the bill, has said that he thinks the death penalty provisions are too harsh. The Minister for Ethics and Integrity, James Nasaba Batoro, has said on several occasions that the death penalty provisions will be dropped, and even Bahati himself has said that the death penalty provision is something we are moving away from. So, this is a good thing, right? Well, yes and no. Obviously, the fact that the Ugandan government now no longer proposes to execute people for being homosexual is a good thing. But in all the uproar about the death penalty clauses, people seem to have overlooked the other horribly draconian and inhumane parts of the bill that will pass if they revisit the legislation in the new parliamentary session. It seems likely now that the offence of aggravated homosexuality will, instead of being punishable by death, be punishable by life imprisonment. It could also introduce penalties of 7 years imprisonment for those who aid, abet, counsel or procure homosexual activities, or to anyone who rents a room or a house to a homosexual, and penalties of 3 years to anyone who's aware of an occurrence of homosexual activity and doesn't report it within 24 hours, including doctors treating patients. It was also proposed that the law be extended to allow extradition back to Uganda for any citizen living abroad who engaged in homosexual activity. In an email, Frank Magisha, the executive director of SMUG, Sexual Minorities Uganda, said, "The bill, if passed, whether in its current form or watered down, will stigmatise and increase harassment of gay people in Uganda, drive them underground even further, which will hinder them from accessing treatment, and this will increase on the HIV/AIDS pandemic in Uganda." So how did Uganda end up taking such regressive steps away from gay rights? Many lay the blame on a workshop organised in Kampala in March 2009, which included talks by three American evangelical Christians, Scott Lively, Caleb Lee Brundage and Don Schmerer, all of whom actively oppose gay rights and see homosexuality as a dangerous and promiscuous lifestyle choice which can be cured by prayer. Brundage himself is a former gay man. The theme of the conference was the gay agenda, and it featured talks on how to make gay people straight, how gay men often sodomise teenage boys, and how the gay movement is an evil institution whose goal is to defeat the marriage-based society and replace it with a culture of sexual promiscuity. Some of the most vocal advocates for the bill attended and reported on these sessions. Uganda's opposition to gay rights may also stem from the country's fear of HIV. Uganda is a rare success story when it comes to HIV, with the infection rate dropping from 30% in the 1980s to 6.4% by the end of 2008, despite modern contraceptive use being low. If the citizens are told by their religious and governmental leaders that homosexuality leads to an increased HIV infection rate, is it really surprising that they will turn against homosexuals? Whatever its cause, since 2009, anti-homosexual feeling has run at an all-time high in Uganda. Prominent gay rights activist David Kato was murdered in January 2011 after successfully suing the country's Rolling Stone newspaper, who had published his picture in 2010 alongside the pictures of other known homosexuals, with a banner saying, "Hang them." Regardless of whether this bill comes into law in its original form or an amended one, or indeed at all, now is the time for the international community to extend a hand to the gay people of Uganda to try and stem the tide of human rights abuses that they're suffering.
And that's it for this week's show. Do check out our website at poddelusion.co.uk, where excitingly, and this is dead exciting, so make sure you pay attention if you've only been drifting in and out, we've got the official podcast of the Uncaged Monkey Tour. Free Primates. Robin Ince, Brian Cox, Simon Singh and hopefully Ben Goldacre are recording special podcasts backstage answering some of the questions from the audiences of the various dates on the tour that have already occurred. You can find all this exclusively at poddelusion.co.uk. Also on our website you can listen back to last Wednesday's London Skeptics in the Pub, which was given by Ginger Campbell on the subject of neuroscience. And of course, you can listen back to older episodes and follow us on Facebook and Twitter, or even find out how to get involved in the show yourself. The Pod Delusion this week was brought to you by Sean Ellis, Jenny Rigg, James Firth, Salim Fadley, Liz Luckendorf, Jean Domain, Natalie Zerins, and me, James O'Malley. The Pod Delusion is a partner of the British Humanist Association. Thanks for listening.